This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 10th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 153, with me, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove. On this week's show, we'll be joined by comedy royalty to discuss a comedy god, as director Robert W. Wydee talks to us about his Woody Allen documentary.
And we'll be discussing the evolution of the London Square and the role of green space in The Big Smoke with landscape designer Todd Longstaff Gowan.
Plus, we'll be heading over to Spain to find out about one of the oddest events on their cultural calendar, the annual Baby Jumping Festival, happening today.
All that, plus some great music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, hello, Sophie. We're kind of hunkered down, haven't we? Because it's been the most miserable week in London.
It's hammering with rain pretty much all week.
I know, miserable. It was miserable for the Jubilee, which we've had enough of as well.
I know. If I see another picture of the Queen, I mean, obviously they're everywhere anyway on coins, but it's really been, we've OD'd on royal celebrations. Thank you.
Yeah, we don't mind seeing her on the back of a banknote, but actually, beyond that, we've had enough. And did you go and see any of the pageant at the beginning of the week?
I saw a little bit, a few boats go past, the flotilla. And then I got horribly rained on and had to more or less go home and dry off for the rest of the weekend.
Now, I did see a bit of the flotilla, and I don't want to be dragged away to the Tower for saying this. I thought it was a bit boring, actually.
Yeah, it was rather. It was very Dickensian because it was so sort of, it looked smoggy and sort of misty. And then there were these little boats with some very stoic-looking British people sort of standing to salute.
And they were very little boats as well, weren't they? Because I was thinking, if you were living in Hong Kong and you just looked out at the harbour, you'd see all these amazing ships going up and down all day. And then you came to London and there was kind of a few canoeists.
And a couple of pedalos.
Anyway, let's not be miserable. We're going to have to cheer ourselves up a bit today. Because in a minute we're going to be having a very interesting guest who's going to talk to us about the world of film, Mr. Woody Allen.
I'm very excited, actually. I'm a big fan of Mr. Allen.
Good. Well, should we have a quick pause and then we can have him in? Now, our first guest is a man whose relationship with comedy goes beyond raising a few laughs. When he's not screenwriting and directing for hits such as Curb Your Enthusiasm, Robert W. Wydee's lens focuses on the lives of his favourite comedy heroes. His 1998 Lenny Bruce documentary was Oscar-nominated, and this year he returns with Woody Allen, a documentary, a labour of love that's taken 20 years to come to fruition. Robert, a very warm welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Before we start, could you just explain a little bit about this documentary? Because I understand it's had a kind of a TV life a year ago, and now it's kind of reappeared as a movie.
Yeah, it's a little confusing. There are two versions of this. What I did originally was I produced this in the States for public television. And I went into the editing room thinking I would do a two-hour film, and I was disabused of that notion within days, realizing, you know, there's just far too much material. So I called up PBS and I said, can I have two nights and do 3.5 hours? And they said, yes, there'll be no more money for it, but if you can do it, do it. So I did, and I still needed to do something of a reasonable length for the cinemas. There was no theatrical in the States, but for, you know, England and elsewhere. So then from the 3.5 hour version, I cut it down to a 2 hour version. That's what's in cinemas. And if somebody sees it in the cinema and is such a big Woody Allen fan that they need even more, I think the longer version will be out on DVD eventually.
And the other thing, just to clear up before we start, is it's billed as authorized. Now, in what sense is it authorized? Did Mr. Allen work with you alongside this? Did he approve scripts or edits? Or?
No, not at all. In fact, people find this interesting. I find it interesting. He had no concern about content or creative control. He didn't ask to see questions in advance. There was nothing that was off limits. By authorized, it simply means that he himself appears in the film, so obviously he had to agree to this film to be on camera. And also, you know, he still maintains strict control of his film work in terms of you know, the studios that own any number of his films, for them to license a clip from that film, they still need Woody's sign-off on it. So if Woody hadn't authorized the film, they wouldn't have been able to give me the clips. And also it helps when you're going to interview subjects like Penelope Cruz or Diane Keaton or whatever, who may not talk to somebody who's just, you know, doing a film on their own. As soon as you say, you know, this is authorized by Woody, then they relax and they give you the interview.
I wanted to know how you convinced him to do it in the first place, because he's notoriously publicity shy and he doesn't really like to do too much of this type of thing. Was it difficult to get him on board?
Yes, it was. And it's interesting because, again, as I say, there were no concerns about content or creative control. It all came from his self-deprecating streak of thinking, and this is not false modesty, this is really how he thinks, is he says, well, who am I to warrant a documentary like this? You know, I'm not Bergman, I'm not Kurosawa or De Sica. I mean, he, you know, he thinks of these great world directors and he doesn't see himself as being in that league. So he was just sort of embarrassed by the whole notion, and even in giving interviews for the film, didn't want to seem complicit in his own tribute, so to speak. So it was a very hard nut to crack. Now, I first met him 30 years ago. He was in my first documentary on the Marx Brothers, because we share this love of the Marx Brothers. And I started to approach him back then. And I was young enough, you know, he politely turned me down, as was expected. But I was young enough at the time that I thought, I can keep going back to this guy every decade or so and still have a few more chances to try to talk him into it, which finally I did. So once he agreed to do it, once I got him over that hurdle of, you know, relax, there'll be an audience for this, people will want to see it, people will be interested in it. You know, you have made a contribution that's worthy of this kind of study. Once he agreed to do it, he was very, very open and cooperative. And you can see in the interviews, he's surprisingly relaxed and comfortable with me. I mean, we actually had a very, very nice rapport. And, you know, he took me, at my request, he gave me a tour of his old neighborhood in Brooklyn. He allowed me to film him on the film set of Tall Dark Stranger, which was shot here in London. So he gave me opportunities that really no other filmmaker has had.
Can I ask you, there's a cliched version of his career which runs that, you know, he did those early movies which everyone loved and understood and that were funny, and then he had a period when he wasn't funny and people didn't like him, and then there's a fallow patch, and then there's a return with his most kind of recent films. Do you buy that, or do you think that they are just films to be understood less, or do you think he lost his creative power at some point? Why do you think that everyone has this, you know, almost off-pat version of his career?
Well, you know, it's all very subjective. I mean, I could tell you my favorite Woody Allen films, and there would be titles in there that you'd say, really? You like that one? And then you could tell me the ones you like, and there'd be a few that I'd think, oh boy, I never need to see that one again. So I think, first of all, it's all a matter of personal taste. You know, we do discuss this in the documentary, that there was this period in the late 90s, early 2000s, where there were a few films in a row that I'm not certain about overseas, but they did not perform well in the U.S. For the most part, the critics didn't care for them so much and people didn't really show up. And there was some thinking at the time that, all right, well, you know, he had a good 30-year run or 35-year run. Maybe he's played himself out. And even though I guess the reception was mixed in the UK, in the States, Matchpoint was the big comeback for him. And people thought he was back in form, which was interesting because that was such an atypical Woody Allen film in that it was a murder suspense thriller. And but it found an audience. And then people said, oh, well, he's gotten out of the country now. He's in England. He's making films. This has renewed him. Or Scarlett Johansson is his new muse. And then he did a film called Scoop, which was also shot in England with Scarlett Johansson. Nobody went to see that. And then they thought, well, okay, maybe Matchpoint was an anomaly. And then, you know, he did another film that didn't do well. And then it was Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which, again, was a big hit. And then another period where there was nothing. And then Midnight in Paris. So I just think it's film by film. You know, he says to me, it's not like you put more or less effort into any one film. You put in the same amount of effort. You throw it out there and people will either show up or they won't. He thinks it's a crapshoot, and I think he's probably right.
Just on that, it's funny that you reference you and me to Tall Dark Stranger, and I only recently watched that, And actually, it's a small movie, but I thought a wonderful movie, incredibly English in a way.
Yes.
And the kind of the cast that he'd used, you know, it was, you know, how do you know these actors almost? It was so English.
Right.
But actually, I think actually you're right. It's the scale of some of them. You imagine they're all going to be big movies, and some of them are much smaller, tighter, almost one-handers in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think personally, again, this is just my own opinion, I think Tall Dark Stranger is every bit as good a film in some ways as Midnight in Paris. Now, I sort of understand why Midnight in Paris took off the way it did, but I think Tall Dark Stranger is a perfectly wonderful film. Boy, that did no business in the States. And Midnight in Paris has been his biggest hit financially of his career. So, again, you know, he says in the film that he's working on the quantity theory, which is that if you keep making a film a year, which he's done now for 43 years, and keep making, you know, year after year after year, one film after another, in his words, every now and then one of them will come out okay. Now, let's take a conservative view and say that maybe one out of every four Woody Allen films is a great film or a very good film. Okay, fine, one out of four, you know, but after 43 films, that means there's 11 great films. That's a lot of great or very good films for any director to have under their belt. And again, people can debate over which are the great ones and which are not so great, but he just, that's in his nature to keep making them, and I'm sure there'll be a few more great ones before he's through.
I wanted to ask you about his women, his muses, because as you just said, he seems to be inspired by certain actresses or people, and they seem to really alter his creative output. What did they have to say about him?
Well, you know, other than the relationship with Mia, which, as we know, did not end so well, with the other women in his life, he's continued to maintain good relationships with. I mean, Louise Lasser, who was his second wife, is in some of those early films. They're still friendly. He and Diane Keaton are still absolutely best friends, and he never makes a move without running it by her. He shows her cuts of the films. I think she even reads some of his scripts, and he really trusts her judgment. Scarlett Johansson, who is the latest one who people have attached that phrase to, his muse, they remain very friendly. He would love to do another picture with her. You know, for the most part, all actors really, but women really adore working with him. And one of the things I like about Woody is that he unapologetically loves women. I mean, he doesn't hide that fact. He says he much prefers the company of women over men. You know, he still develops little, you know, set crushes on actresses and that sort of thing. He leads a very domesticated life now. He's been married for 17 years. He has two kids that he takes to school every day and all of that. But he just really appreciates women. And I think for the most part that the feeling is mutual.
Now, Robert, if you could just stay with us, we're going to have a short break, but then we're going to come back to talk to you more about your documentary about Woody Allen. We're talking to Robert Wydie, and we'll be back after this.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This she makes me wanna dance. Is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
Long overshadowed by its neighbor, Seoul's creative community is flourishing as a new generation of designers are developing new projects and pieces. Monocle's Gabriel Lee traveled to South Korea to meet some of the people leading the charge.
Indeed, many in the creative community here have studied or worked abroad and now come back, melding their experience in the world with a Korean aesthetic and creating something new and appealing. This is the first generation to have done this on such a scale.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove. And we have in studio Robert W. Wydie, who's here to talk about his new documentary about Woody Allen. I wanted to ask you about another character that appears in all of his films, which is, I think, amazing, which is usually a city. When I was, you know, a teenager, I kind of wanted to go to New York just because of those early films. His portrayal of the city, even if he was looking at the city in the 30s or in his childhood, the period of his childhood, there was something about it that was a real proper character in all the movies. And he's done the same with Barcelona and with Paris and with London. Do you think that he's, you know, that he understands how, you know, a city works more than anything else? Is it the architecture? What is it about his films that have such a sense of amazing place in them, do you think?
Well, of course, the romance with New York has to do with the fact that he grew up, outside of Manhattan and New York City. I mean, he grew up in Brooklyn, which is like a borough of New York. But he thought of Manhattan as this very magical place. And the thing is, that sense of wonder about the city, even though, you know, it's full of crime and litter and everything, graffiti and everything else, you know, that sense of magic has never really left him. So it was easy for him to portray the city in those terms. I mean, in Manhattan, you never see a piece of litter or graffiti or whatever. It makes it look like this little jewel. And now I grew up in Los Angeles, so I saw that film. And boy, I sure wanted to book myself out to New York right away. And as soon as I did, I made a beeline for the Queensboro Bridge, which is where he's sitting with Diane Keaton. And I don't know, you know, he loves cities. It's why he doesn't like Los Angeles at all, because Los Angeles is not a proper city in that it's so spread out. There are different districts of it, and there's no real central part of the city. And, you know, parts of the city are miles away, and you live in your car, and there's no real street life or anything. So he likes the vibrancy of those sorts of cities. And, you know, I think, you know, he quite likes London. He obviously adores Paris. And what's interesting now is that these, to really answer your question as to his understanding of the city, I can't really speak to that. But I can tell you that, you know, now that he's sort of this world filmmaker and making these films that sort of get people on the phone the next day, you know, booking flights with their travel agent. I guess people go online now and do that. They don't really have travel agents. But in any event, he's just got this queue of countries lining up saying, please make a movie here and do for us what you did for Barcelona or Paris. And, you know, so long as he's got a good idea for that territory and if the situation is right, he'll do it.
I wanted to ask you about sort of Woody, the man, and it's interesting to look back at those films where he actually starred himself. I wonder to what extent is a character like you know, the one he plays in Annie Hall autobiographical? He's so sort of you know, introverted and so into psychoanalysis, and like, you know, this wonderful angsty person that he portrays and incredibly funny. Is that what he's like in real life?
There's a little bit of, well, a little bit. I mean, there's definitely crossover between the sort of public persona of Woody Allen and who he really is. I mean, I think the mistake people make is taking some of these films as being truly autobiographical, which they aren't. I mean, even something like Annie Hall, which is clearly based on his real-life relationship with Diane Keaton, you know, that's not how they met, that's not how they broke up. The narrative isn't really theirs, but, you know, the dynamic is certainly theirs. And the Woody Allen characters in the movies, whether or not they're played by him or a surrogate like Owen Wilson or John Cusack or whatever, you know, for the most part are espousing thoughts and philosophies and ideas and insights that Woody Allen really has. But, and, you know, Woody is a combination, from what I've witnessed, is a combination of some of those kind of neurotic tendencies and the eccentricities, but there's a surprisingly calm, confident, level-headed element to him as well. I wrote an article, I was asked to write an article for the Washington Post back in the States about Woody on the set and how he works with actors, and I called the article The Zen of Woody Allen, and Zen is not a word you think of as applying to him that much, but on the set, he's such a calm presence, and these, you know, little disasters that pop up on every film set every day would pop up, and people would be very worried about it. He'd say, that's okay, look, we'll do it this way, or, you know, we'll shoot the scene instead. And nothing throws him. So in that way, he's quite different from the very nervous, neurotic Woody Allen character. But, you know, he actually has no ability with mechanical objects. You know, he's very, very shy. So making small talk with strangers is very difficult for him. You know, he has his little circle of friends and family and people that he trusts. That's one thing, but he's very awkward socially. So there is crossover, but there are also a lot of differences between the public and between the Woody Allen character and the actual man.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for coming in to see us. Now, tell me, the film is just about to be released here?
Well, it premiered here in the UK on Friday evening, so it's playing now. Of course, I encourage all Woody Allen fans and any fans of cinema to go see it. And it's opening different dates around Europe and around the world now. And I believe down the road, what will eventually be released on DVD will be the long version as it appeared on television in the States. But obviously, people should go to the cinemas now. And if you're a real Woody Allen fan and need more, then you'll have the DVD in a few months.
Well, thank you again so much for coming in to see us today. We'll be back right after this.
This summer has seen scenes of bare-legged abandon as Londoners basked in the sun in their nearest green space. Parks and squares are the city's green lungs. Of course, it has to be said, more recently the relentless rain has dampened spirits and ruined picnics. Nevertheless, despite the weather, squares are one of London's most coveted and defining features. One person who knows a lot about them is landscape architect and gardener Todd Longstaff Gowan. His new book, The London Square, looks at the history and current state of London's green spaces. Todd, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. We're huge fans of the book. It's very beautiful, incredibly detailed. Labour of love, I think. Tell me about the London Square. Do you think, from your research, that London more or less invented the square?
Oh, without question. And I think what's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city, and although it's been adopted in other countries, cities across Britain and abroad, it's always been at home in London. And it has to do with so many things that we love here and so many things we hate about ourselves as well. So everything from snobbery to enclosure and other things like this. But it's a fantastic, it's sort of an encapsulation of the average Londoner.
And how did it all start? I mean, we have so many squares here, especially Victorian ones and ones from the 18th century. What's the evolution of the square?
Squares really, when London is trying to sort of reinvent itself as a more cosmopolitan international city in the late 16th, early 17th century, we look abroad because we're travelling more often to the continent. And we look at these, what we call these dusty open piazzas that you see, or place on the continent. And we bring it back home, but we're not happy just having, as it were, regular buildings surrounding our open spaces. We decide we have to elaborate them, and they later become gardens. But it's really the marriage of two traditions, a continental regular piazza with sort of palace fronts around it, with the London and English tradition of a common, with just green. And really the first squares are just big open spaces with a little bit of greenery, and they become gardens much later.
Now, in London, there's a kind of a strange piece of history, isn't there? Because these squares were not really kind of open to everyone when they were first built. They were mainly kind of fenced off, and you had to be a resident to get into them.
Absolutely, and that's been the tradition because they were often built in the centre of large urban estates. And the landowners realised that first, what's unusual about London is that most of the great people who lived here because they had to for business, but preferred to live in the country. So the square was a wonderful thing because it brought people together who would ordinarily not want to live a mile apart. And they were forced to live in these very small, close quarters. But they live in these great sort of town palaces that surrounded these open spaces. And they would pay for this amenity and for its maintenance because we have this tradition, as you know, that we always like to enclose things to make them feel better and make them look better. And we always think that if you put a fence around something, that it's going to behave. And it's this idea also of exclusion. And this is really what appeals to everyone, is that you can take a space. And the first spaces aren't elaborated and are left open. They realise that they're subject to the most terrible depravities. Everything from dumping cats and rubbish to firework displays and horrible displays of antisocial behaviour. So it's really important, they think, to enclose these. So these are really pre-parliamentary enclosures.
And I was just going to say, but even today there seems to be a kind of balance between the ones which are actually now public spaces. So, for example, Bloomsbury Square in London is now very much open to anybody who wants to go there, where in the past it was private. And then other squares, Eaton Square, for example, where you'd need a key to kind of enjoy the amenity.
Yeah, what's so true is that the squares that remain, in my view, the most characterful, most idiosyncratic and eccentric, are the ones that still have private ownership around the houses. And you need that base of people living in a square to actually sustain them, because they've always been rated, as it were, by the inhabitants who look after the square, and they collect a rent, as it were, a rate from the people who live there to contribute to the maintenance and the enclosure and all the other amenities that go with it. So if these people evaporate, as they did after the Second World War, or even in some squares in the 19th century, you lose that rateable base, so there's no money to keep the place going. And when you have single-family houses going to multiple occupation, it just means that people say, well, I have no benefit to the square, I'm not paying the rate. So whereas you may have had 60 people one time, then you go up to sort of 300. It's hard to regulate the space. But that's really what's happened to so many spaces. But in my view, the best ones are still private, because you always have a dragon or two that looks after them, and they sort of make sure that everyone collects the rents and everyone has, you know, that not too many people have a say in what's going on, but they keep it beautiful and rather wonderfully idiosyncratic, which is what one really likes about the squares in, let's say, Kensington or other areas like that, where we still have lots of private squares, because they reflect the taste of the people who are there and they look after them.
And I love the book because it shows those little quirks that you're talking about. Constantly these wonderful figures pop up and these crazy little goings-on happen in the squares. Did you find that this was just a pleasure to research?
Oh, yes. I wanted to do a warts and all sort of approach to the square, because we have a very narrow view of what the square is, and it's almost always this idea of 18th century engravings with the lovely open space and, you know, perambulating children and nannies and things like that. And it, in fact, they're full of horrible things as well. And it's that great, it shows both sides of the character of the people who live there. This idea of, they police these enclosures, and they try and maintain this these little defensible places that were compared to little principalities in Europe, like little kingdoms that people defend with all their rails, and they had their standing armies and their own government and finances and things. And they really were extraordinary, the way they operated, like little towns or villages. And in fact, they were called little towns when they were first started. But yes, because you can rail nuisances out, but you can also rail them in. And that's what fascinates me too, because the inhabitants were also took advantage of sometimes of the circumstances that allowed them to do things in the gardens that they couldn't do elsewhere.
Now, the square has come back into fashion in a way. People love living on these squares. People are trying to build contemporary versions of them. But there is a period in your book which you realise it was a terrible kind of misunderstanding of their value in a way. So you see these hideous plans for what could be done to this wonderful square, Bloomsbury Square, that's right in the centre of London, the idea of really kind of bulldozing the buildings and making it into it looked like something out of Brasilia rather than out of London. The same was envisaged for Covent Garden. And then some of the other squares were just destroyed during the war and never rebuilt properly. So there's a really beautiful engraving here you have in the book of Red Lion Square, for example, from 1725. But on the whole, that's been kind of obliterated. There's another beautiful illustration of Brunswick Square, which I happen to live quite near and is now kind of there's a picture of a woman sitting in a park reading a book, you know, looking at these majestic houses. Well, that's all long gone. Do you think that we've come to re-understand the value of those squares? And do you think there was a period where we faced losing them?
Absolutely. I mean, since squares were almost always the perquisite of the upper middle classes and the aristocracy, there was a period when they were frowned upon by many people as London got bigger and bigger. And certainly in the 19th century, when most of the boroughs sold up a lot of their common space, there was immense pressure to create green spaces in the centre of London. And the squares were a natural place for everyone to pick on, because they said, oh, here we've got these wonderful green spaces, they should just be open to the public. But the owners of these squares said, well, you know, just we're not interested in handing this over to you, because the only reason it's here is because we've looked after it and we pay for it. But so that's this curious thing. But in the 19th century, there's great urge to create open space, but they know they can't obliterate the squares because they need these lungs in the middle of town, because they're so important to give green and air and space and light. But so they're sort of saved in that regard. And then in the late 19th, early 20th century, when there's all sorts of competition to build other things, they're also saved again by this tendency to protect the squares as sort of special amenities you'd find in town again, and more as a listed space, as we call it now, a whole community. So there are threats to build cinemas and any number of things, car parks. And for the first time, the squares are actually recognised as contributing to the entire, the whole of the city. And that's really with the development of the LCC in the late 19th century too, because they begin to realise that squares are valuable amenities. And that's when they start to quantify how many there are, how much they do, and how much value they actually add to everything. And interestingly, even when the railings start to come down in the Second World War, there's a great public interest that the square should revert somewhere, well, never public, but should open to the public. But the government doesn't even really want to do this, largely because so many of the members of the government lived on squares. But secondly, I think also because there was an argument that it was very expensive keeping small gardens. It was six times more expensive to look after a small square than it was to look after a park. So the councils were much happier to say, well, let's look after the big parks and let's hand the squares back to their owners and they can look after them at their own expense. So there's always been this terrible moment when they might disappear and they've been reprieved sort of endless times. And I think now we're at a moment where their future seems more secure, but there still are lots of horrible things that take place in and around them that you know, people should be more aware of. And what I was seeking to do, and I hope one can do in the book, is to just show people the rich history of the square and how, so they have a broad appreciation of how these things work, how they're really wonderful social organisms. And it's not, you just don't make a square like a new developer's thing, so you just plop one in and just make all the houses very expensive. It's all about, like parks and any kinds of urban gardens, we have to teach people how to use these places, these amenities. Just as in parks, as you may know, in the 19th century, used to shoot geese and things because they weren't used to behaving in these new sort of organisms. So in squares, you had to teach people how to use their spaces too. And they always had lots of regulations and rules and a strict code of conduct. And this is important too, that all open space really requires, since you're mingling with so many different people, these special kinds of rules to guide the maintenance and the use of the places.
I wanted to ask you about the garden element of it that you just mentioned. There's this very English notion of this wonderful bucolic little microcosm of Englishness. And it seems like there was a moment in history when English designers decided on that, as opposed to, you know, this kind of dusty gravel sort of promenade that you see on the continent.
It was really born of the fact that in about the early 18th century, when it was realised that some of the greatest open spaces, as they were called then, were being very badly abused, the owners decided that what they could actually do is resort to the law, get private acts of parliament passed for the enclosure of these spaces. And they were really to enclose and to embellish. And this is when, these are really, as I say, proto-enclosure acts. And it's all about taking a space and the exclusion of the people who used to use it, just chucking them out, really, in many cases, and saying, well, we'll look after this better. So what you do is put up railings or fences, a lot of kind of barricades around the gardens. And then when they enclose them, they decide that, of course, you don't just want a bald patch, that it's better to actually start planting it. And that's how the gardens evolve, as they just become more and more complex. And also with the advent of things like transparent railings or screens, you know, cast iron in the 18th century, the big, heavy fences and timber palisades can disappear. And then you have these new open views into the square. And also we must remember that our perceptions of squares now are really big trees and gardens. When you look across, just I'm walking up here today and just seeing Manchester Square down the road, and you see it as a giant, jungly mass of trees. In the 18th century and earlier, these were perceived as open spaces, and they were rarely, you saw them as places of light. So when you look down these narrow streets, as they were much more narrow than now, you'd see actually pools of light. So our perception of how these read in the city has changed immensely. But it really, the evolution of the square has also sort of followed more or less the taste in gardens in general, because it was a metropolitan sort of form of garden. So certainly with the rise of the picturesque, gardens become much more heavily planted. You plant big flowering trees and shrubs, and with that come all the problems too, as I elaborate in the book, of sexual misdemeanors.
I was just going to get onto that, because what's really interesting is, you know, that of course there are the kind of grand squares which are behind high fences and padlocked and shut, but there are many other squares where people are kind of climbing over and to get into them. And even if you look at a present square like London's Leicester Square, which has certainly changed from the early engravings in your book, you know, to a place where associated with people being out at night and has been for many years, there is a hint of sex and bawdiness about our squares as well.
Absolutely, and this is the curious thing about it, is there's nothing more attractive, of course, than something you can't get into. And of course you have to realise, even just within the square itself, I mean, a very interesting case is Lincoln's and Fields, which was formed as a wonderful garden. Prior to that, had been a public open space. From the 1740s or 1730s, they enclose it, becomes this garden. And it becomes this wonderful idyllic place. But towards the end of the 18th century, when the gardens are very overgrown, the residential occupation reduces in scale, and you start have young bucks or lawyers moving in. And these chaps decide, well, the gardens are actually quite a good place to philander. So they start taking prostitutes into the gardens. And the difficulty is, of course, that the guards and the beadles look after the square can't really kick them out because they're paying a rate. So they have to sort of, for a while, put up with this until they change the rules. But also servants who lived in the houses or around the square were very fond of using the gardens after hours as well, and because they would steal the keys or just borrow the keys and get into the gardens. And there are wonderful accounts in the early 19th century of servants' screams keeping their masters awake in the morning. But there are any number of things like that, and it really becomes a very popular sort of resort, as it were. And that persists throughout the centuries. But it's quite natural, too, that... and also, you know, under the cover of the shrubs, statues were dismantled, any number of things took place. So it's really a fascinating part of the underbelly.
Can I ask, this might be an agonising question, do you have a favourite square?
Not one, but several, I suppose. There are a few which I think are exemplary. I mean, Edward Square is among the best, I think, really. It was designed curiously by a Frenchman, but it's a fantastic square in West London and very low-rise sort of cottages around it. But still, when you're in the midst of that square, you feel you're in the middle of the countryside. And then I'd say any of those gardens around the Ladbroke Estate are pretty good. And my favourite of those is Stanley Crescent Gardens. But there are so many that offer different aspects, but I think that those are... two of my favourites.
And without revealing too much, do you happen to live on a square?
No, not at all.
Oh, no!
Can't afford it.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today about your wonderful book. And this book is called The London Square, and it's out now?
It is indeed, yes, published by Yale University Press.
And so we can find this on in newsstands, or rather in bookshops from the US to the UK?
Yes, it should be available everywhere.
Good. We like that idea. Well,
thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to see it. And it is an amazing book. And Todd Longstaff, Gowan, good luck with your promotion of it.
Thank you.
We'll be back right after this.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. As a Monocle who's on name.
Welcome to Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λόντεντα, Μπουρεσέ, Monocle 24.
Λόντος το Κασίν, τέμα ον Monocle 24.
Λόντομπο, as a Monocle who's on name.
Λόντεντα, Μπουρεσέ, Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, είναι Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que nina teve no ar, Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Do listen up for Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagatja.
And we're going to have a relevant song now. This is When Your Garden Is Overgrown by Mr. Paul Weller. And that was When Your Garden Is Overgrown by Paul Weller.
Now, a good folklore yarn can add mystery, magic, and even bring money to a tucked-away region. But what if it pulls in the health and safety inspectors too? Today, in the Spanish village of Castrillo de Murcia, the centuries-old ritual of El Colacho takes place to celebrate the Catholic feast of Corpus Christi. El Colacho, or the Devil's Jump, involves devil-costumed villagers leaping over the quite frightening sight of a row of babies who were born in the last year. They say it cleanses the infants of original sin. Our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldis joins us on the line now to discuss this rather quirky ritual. Liam, welcome to the programme.
Hi, how are you? It is rather quirky, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Does sound quite wacky and worrying in some ways. Is it safe?
Well, I've been assured I did manage to find someone who was from the town, and she was actually jumped over as a baby.
Does she have a very flat face?
She has actually lived in Burgos, which is the closest city. But she says as a baby, she was put down on the mattress and jumped over, and she said she came out fine. And actually, in the 400-year history of the event, no baby has been squashed. So, I mean, I tried to do a bit more research and find out if that was true, and as far as I know, no baby has been squashed. So they do have a really good selection process, apparently. I am assured that there's a big panel of judges who sees potential jumpers and potential devil-dressed jumpers, So you don't just have any random person jumping over the babies, thank God.
And are they kind of all lined up? You know, in the old days when there was that guy Evel Knievel, and they had all the buses lined up, and he'd kind of go over on a motorcycle. Is it the jumping equivalent of that? You have like a big lineup of babies to leap over.
Yeah, exactly. Except they're a lot better dressed, these babies. They're on these beautiful mattresses. Sometimes you have maybe six or seven mattresses, and there's about eight babies on each mattress. It's not just you're jumping over one baby, you're jumping over a little group of babies. So it does heighten the tension level a little.
I mean, the jump is quite considerable, as you just said. It's a double mattress, more or less packed with babies. I was quite shocked when I saw the picture. Did you know how far is it, and is it quite an athletic kind of ritual as well as being this kind of Corpus Christi this Catholic ritual?
Well, it is quite a big jump. I mean, you've got to jump over a whole mattress, but I think they design the whole festival so babies aren't hurt. I mean, apparently it's a big deal. I mean, if you don't put your baby down, your child is seen as maybe a potential curse or could have a lot of evil in its life. So it's like you said, it's a festival to purge the evil from the babies and to purge the babies from original sin, as well as to cleanse the town. And the whole festival actually goes for 5 days, but the baby jumping is at the end. And what worried me more was that the first day, on the Wednesday, the devils go around the town with their whips and truncheons menacing the little kids. So the kids are out in the streets and they run around trying to whip the kids. So, I mean, it's not just the babies that are in danger, it's the whole range of youngsters.
Now, I did pull up here on my laptop. There's an image of, so just so people know what it's like. So there's a mattress on the floor. There's kind of like two rows of pillows. And on the first tier, there's like four babies lined up. And then on the second tier, there's another three or four babies lined up. And there's a guy who looks like he's dressed as Elvis. He's in some kind of like yellow and red nice outfit. And he's kind of leaping across the babies, not kind of from side to side, but from the end of the bed to the top of the bed. And they're actually just kind of lying there looking happy, and the kind of mothers are hanging around, not seemingly too bothered about it.
It's like an alternative christening, really, isn't it?
Yeah, a Spanish christening. And actually, it's interesting to say that the Pope Benedict has actually asked Spanish priests to distance themselves from the festival. So the boars up in the Vatican aren't really happy with this kind of slant on the purging of evil. So I think it's great because the whole town comes together and everyone seems to join in, and it's quite a fun day or fun week.
It's kind of a Spanish take on bed hopping, isn't it?
Exactly.
So maybe you should have a go, Liam.
Oh, I'll have to get down there. I have to take more. Maybe I'll try and have a newborn this year and take it down there to rid it of soon.
You better get cracking. But also, it sounds very pagan. As you said, the Catholic Church aren't too happy about it. And it sounds like it goes back a long way. Do we know about the history of it, where this tradition started?
Well, you know, it's been going on for hundreds of years, and it's only actually in this town, so it must be. I mean, a lot of villages in Spain have their unique little week-long festivals, and some of them are actually quite barbaric as well. I mean, this one is actually quite tame. It's been called the most dangerous festival in the world, but there are other ones particularly worrying for animal rights lovers where, I mean, there's one in Catalonia where they throw a goat off a tower, and that's meant to be a big celebration as well. I mean, it's not very good for the goat. There's another one where they string up a goose on a big cable over a river, and our boats go out, and you have to jump up and grab the head of the goose and rip the head of the goose off. It's actually quite squirmish. It's not squeamish. It's not very nice. So when you consider those kinds of festivals, the baby jumping festival is all right, I think.
But it is interesting, I guess, then, that all these villages, they do retain lots of kind of local traditions in a way that actually in other parts of Europe they may have been wiped out.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the people that live in the cities are actually quite ashamed of these little festivals. I think it gives a bad image to Spain, whereas the villagers, the locals, are quite proud of them. And when I talked to Sylvia, the girl who was jumped over, she said it's just normal. I mean, when you come from the village, you think it's normal, it's not a big deal. And when I said it's actually been called the most dangerous festival in the world, she kind of was surprised and didn't really believe me. And she said, well, when I think about it, if you're looking at the town from outside, I suppose it is a little strange. But she seemed to think it was just natural and just the annual event on the town's calendar.
So you quite like your job as the Madrid correspondent for Monocle 24. You seem to have a kind of a weirder job every single day.
Yeah, Spain just keeps me working very hard with these amazing festivals and events. I mean, the news here is very can be very depressing with the economic situation, but there's a lot of lighthearted news items as well. So yeah, it does keep me entertained at least.
That was our Monocle correspondent and bed-hopping expert, Liam Aldous, joining us on the line from Madrid. Well, that's almost all for this week. That was good, but I liked speaking to Liam Aldous.
I know, I did. I think he should have a go. I saw him the other day and he looked like he could be quite good at the long jump.
He's quite fit, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
I mean, athletic.
he popped into the office in between his sangria and wonderful Fino Sherry themed posting out there in Madrid.
Well, let's just say I happened to be in Mexico when he came to visit and I wasn't here. And so he used my desk. People started taking pictures of him at my desk and posting them to me saying, oh, look, the editor's suddenly got attractive. Which I didn't think was very nice.
No.
So I begrudgingly like Liam Aldous.
That is rather, that he's trying to usurp you, potentially.
I know.
Sitting at the editor's desk.
I know, well, he's certainly, he's welcome.
He's welcome, very welcome,
Whenever he comes here. It is quite nice. We have a good rotation, don't we, of the visiting correspondents as they come to town.
It's lovely to see them in real life, because we speak to them so much down the line.
And especially at this time of year, because next weekend, we have a bit of a festivity happening here in Madrid. We have a country fair with a Y.
Exactly, a very British tradition. To rival any baby jumping, I'd like to say. They're going to be quirks and lots of fun.
Now, this is actually open to anybody who would like to attend. You need to make a donation at the door because we're going to be raising money for kind of journalists who do work in tough places. But it's the Monocle Country Fair.
It is at Madrid House on Dorset Street, and it's going to be on, I think it starts at 11 in the morning till 5 on Saturday and Sunday.
And the twist is that the country element is real countries. So we have the likes of Colombia, the Danish embassy, the Swedish embassy. They're taking stands, aren't they?
And we have Wales.
They're taking stands against things. It sounds like they're going to be protesting. Yeah, we're not Wales is in the country. We have one woman representing Wales who's not even Welsh, but anyway.
But the idea is they come and sort of, you know, showcase their all of their wonderful products and also there's going to be a petting zoo with lots of animals and games. And so that's the traditional
English. Face painting, food, drink. I believe there's going to be a DJ or two, maybe a live act or two. And some games that you're in charge of.
I am. It's going to be absolute fun. And also, there'll be a few surprises on the performance front. But I'm not going to give too much away. You'll have to come along.
Do you think we could introduce a Monocle version of baby jumping?
That would be inspiration.
Quite good, yeah.
I mean, look no further. I think that a lot of the mothers in this building will be very willing to just offer up their little babies for you to...
So if you're in the W1 area next week, bring your newborn and a Lilo and help raise money for journalists.
At the Monocle Country Fair with a Y.
Yes. I'm slightly taking the mickey out of you, but you got to do the promotional, the promo we call it, don't we, on Monocle 24 for the Country Fair.
That's because I'm the most enthusiastic Country Fair goer.
Did you script it?
Well, I did, actually. And with Paul Noble.
And you say very elegantly and eloquently.
Country Fair.
With a Y.
But it has to be said, otherwise people might get confused and think that it was something else.
That we were charging them a ticket to go to the country.
Fair play.
Okay. Well, fair play, there may be fair play, and after a few drinks there may be foreplay. Anyway, we'll move on. because really that is literally enough of me and Sophie Grove for this week. And that's all for this episode of the Monocle Weekly. This show was produced by Tom Hall and the engineer was Jack Phillips, who's got a tan from being in Thailand.
Lucky boy.
Country fair boy. But that really is all from us, and we're going to see you off with Devil's Work by Mike Snow.
Here is so sharp and they cut the light from a primitive sun.